Tasted it? Really? Great? Yes, I joined the club of the people that want to challenge the Higgs mechanism and see what happens. After all, physics is like that. If you have more than one theory, then it's better than having only one. And the idea of this research is exactly to see whether experiments can decide between two or more theories. What I'm saying is not in the textbook, and I will say precisely when, at what point the theory is not anymore on the textbook. And so if you want to destroy myself, my seminar, that is the point where you should raise your hand and say, no, this is nonsense. Okay, let us start from a very simple example, which is particle data group. If you look at the mass of the photons, you don't find zero, but you find an upper bound, an upper value, which is 10 to the minus 18 electron volt, which I think is measured by using the magnetic field of Jupiter. And it's not difficult to make, to introduce a mass for the photons. It's called the Broca field. And if you want to make it up as a very standard theory, that means with everything, gauge invariant, and with kinetic term which is invertible, so everything is according to the canonical rules, then you end up with the Stueckelberg mass. As you see, no pointer. As you see, the mass term is gauge invariant, because when you change a mu, this one gets corresponding.
This is cannabis.
Yes, I understand. The variation of a mu is balanced by the variation of phi. And at the end of the day, if you have to interpret the theory, you have to prove that the new degrees of freedom are decoupled on the physical state. So this is more or less the pattern that I will follow to construct a theory of the electroweak model without the X field. So these are the main items. Essentially, up to here is the standard quantum field theory. From now on, I will drop the renormalization requirement of the theory, and I show how to do the calculation. Well, let us start from the textbook. So you introduce the Higgs field by a doublet of SU2 doublet, and you can play a very simple trick that means double this, use a matrix, which I call omega, which is, this line is essentially the conjugate of this one. In this way, you write this in terms of Pauli matrices, which are this one. The X interaction with the non-abelian field is through minimal coupling. If you use omega, you can write in the following way. When you write the interaction between A mu and the X field, you realize that you can put the constraint that phi naught is not anymore a free degree of freedom, but is given by the square root of 1 minus phi square. So this page tells you that formally you can introduce the constraint within the theory of the standard model just by imposing this constraint. And it looks like the Stueckelberg mass is for the photons. This is the term which balances the variation, the gauge transformation of A mu is balanced by this one. So this one, which is a flat connection, if omega is an element of the SU2 group. F mu nu is transformed like a gauge field, but the tensor, the field strength tensor is zero. So we have succeeded formally to write down a theory which is gauge invariant and has a mass term. So what are the problems? You can also, before going forward with the problems, you can introduce the mass for the fermions, like in the standard model, by using the this enlarged X field. That means this is the omega matrix. This is the left part of the fermion, right part of the fermion. And as you see, when you take the field to zero, only phi naught is equal to 1, and you have a mass term for the for the fermions. Please notice that there is no vacuum expectation value. It's been taken away just by rescaling the field. So the only parameters are the mass of the fermions. There is no V, the vacuum expectation value, is not a physical parameter. We have Gostom boson, of course, which are these, 1, 2, and 3. And now we have the problems. When you look at the F squared term which comes from the mass, you see that this is a typical nonlinear sigma model theory, so which has this coupling. And as you see, it is a four legs interaction with two momenta. That means that all diagrams like that are divergence at one loop, because you have a p-square here, p-square here, p-square. Each of them kills the propagator. So this is divergent. At one loop, all the graphs involving the phi are divergent, all of them. So the theory is not renormalizable. So here is the end of the textbook, and we go on trying to see what we can do. In order to make the seminar not so heavy, I'm speaking about only to the nonlinear sigma model, but the same method and the same procedure can be used for the electroweak case. That means SU2 cross U1. So this is the nonlinear sigma model action. Is written in D dimensions. This factor is introduced in order to keep the dimension of the fields invariant under the choice of D. So you get the kinetic term for the free degree of freedom, and for the constraint, you have this one. This one generates this interaction. Sorry?
This little V.
V is a scale, it's a mass. In order to make this, so this is dimension one. It's chosen to be dimension, dimension zero. So this one, in order to make this term of dimension four. So this is the only parameter. We have two parameters, V and lambda. This is the, these are the parameters of the theory, and they have both, they have dimension of the mass.
It's not the V in the static model, which is the vacuum.
Is the parameter of the theory. As you know, the nonlinear Sinan model has been considered as a non-renormalizable theory, and then you cannot get final result out of it. The people started to get some final result until the end of the 80s. The last one was Appelquist. Is try to see whether maybe even if you have an infinite number of divergent amplitude, nevertheless you could subtract them in some way. When they discovered that already on one loop you break the invariance of the theory, the chiral invariance, then they gave up. Okay, so we start from this point. What can we do? Well, consider. Yes.
Why?
You mean chiral Carrel Lagrangian?
Any effect field theory.
Carrel Lagrangian is.
No.
Yeah, Carrel. There is no power counting. Carrel Lagrangian is based on the nonlinear sigma model, so in that respect, it's the same. If you do. Soft pion technique is the same problem.
But I can just treat that as an objective theory. I don't know what's wrong with it. But if I just systematically introduce counterterms or some type of power counting.
I want to do more than that. So what is the idea? Well, look at the path integral measure, which has been written in the following way by using the constraint on the five fields. When you choose one of them to depend from the others, that means that you are making a spontaneous breakdown of the symmetry, which of course is O4. Here the action, here the sources in order to define the theory. So the measure is invariant under these transformations. Beware, these are local transformations, local chiral transformation on the fields. I mean, anybody who exactly works in chiral Lagrangian, they know very well. They know very well this transformation. Although they do not consider the x dependence of the parameter. Now, suppose that you transform your field by this transformation locally. The fields are integration variables because you are doing the path integral. So if you change your field by this, the partition function should not change because they are mute variables. Therefore, by using the substitution identity, you get an identity for the path integral functional. This is very similar to what you do when you derive the equation of motions by finding the extremal of the action, but it's a little bit more. It takes into account the presence of a measure in the path interval and of its invariance property. So you get a new equation. You get a new equation which involves not the action, which would be the Hamiltonians in statistical theory, but for the free energy. In our case, we don't discuss the invariance of the action, but the invariance of the effective action. That means the generators of the the generators of the one particle irreducible functions. So, to make a little summary of what we said up to now, we use the invariance of the measure of the path integral, and we consider the identity that works on the effective action. We replace the equation of motion by the new identity, and we replace the action by effective action. The external sources are needed in order to define the composite operator, which is the flat connection, and the constraint variable, which is the order parameter of the theory. And these are the external sources in order to define the Green functions. So suppose you have a new theory. You want to apply the method to another situation, to another theory. What should you do? You find the algebra of all the operators closed under the local transformation which leaves invariant the path integral measure. So you start the machine, turning the machine until you get a closed set of operators. You associate to every composite operator a classical source, and you write down the local function of equation that you obtain by using the invariance of the path integral measure. So this is the home companion for people that wants to attack a new theory with this method.
Is needed because you want the action to be invariant under local transformations rather
yes.
than merely local ones.
Exactly.
But could you not fix the gauge and just...
I'm speaking about the nonlinear sigma model. I have no gauge problems.
Yeah, but you could put that flat connection to zero and then you would only have the global transformations.
Yeah, but then at the end, in the unitary gauge, and then
yes.
I don't know what to do. Already at one loop, I don't know what to do. So this is the equation, which is the central result of the seminar. It looks very complicated, but it's very simple. So this is the effective action. As you see, this is the gauge transformation on the source, which is associated to the flat connection. As you see, this is the translation part of the gauge transformation. This is the rotation part. This is a classical term, which is just a small breaking. This is the transformation on the field phi, which is the part which is the SU2 part, and then is the this is a O4 transformation. So this reflects simply the invariance of the theory. That means the invariant of the path integral measure. But it's an extremely powerful equation. At the lowest, you get the classical action, which can be written in the following way. And then you see immediately the origin of the invariance. This is the flat connection. This is J. If you transform both fields in the same way, that means the field and the external source, this is invariant. The same applies for this gentleman. Now we can start to build our perturbative expansion by using this equation. The starting point is the condition of the spontaneous symmetry breaking. That means you decide to break the symmetry along phi naught. So this is the condition to start with in order to construct the perturbative expansion. So it's hard work, but it is successful. You can construct the whole perturbative series. Now we come to study the property of this equation. As you notice, the equation is not linear. This term is a bilinear in the gamma. This is a very important consequence. That means you have hierarchy. What does it mean? Well, let us give an example. Take the derivative respect to a second J, here, and this goes away when you take the field to zero. This is equal one. So you get a relation between the two-point function of the J and the two-point function phi and J. And this is the relation. And this relation is valid not only at zero loop, but at any loop. That means that you can obtain this two-point function from this two-point function. Then you go back and say, I need this one. You go back and you differentiate with respect to phi, and you get the two-point function of the phi in terms of the two-point function j and phi, and so on and so forth. Then you see that you can obtain all the function which involves at least one phi in terms of function which involve j and phi naught. Where is it? Which is the conjugate of k naught. So we use to call as ancestors all the amplitudes which involve the flat connection and phi naught, and descendant all the functions which involve at least one phi.
Sorry, why do these nonlinear terms vanish when you take j derivatives or phi derivatives?
Well, this is a standard procedure. When you want a two-point function, you make it.
Are those external sources?
Yes.
Oh, I'm
external
sorry.
Field.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. So this is an exceptional result, in the sense that I'm going to prove that at finite number of loops, the number of ancestor amplitudes is finite. Divergent ancestor amplitude is finite. So this, we have a little theorem that tells that all the divergences of the descendant amplitude are dependent from a finite number of ancestor divergence amplitude. I started by saying that already at one loop in the nonlinear sigma model, the number of divergent amplitudes is infinite. Now I'm telling that in the number of independent is finite, which is an extremely powerful result. And this is due to nonlinearity of this term. So that we call hierarchy, of course, because you start from above and you get all the others. Then you play the game of the power counting, only that is not as strong as in renormalizable theory, but is weaker. That means it tells that for any number of finite loops and L, the degree of divergence is given by d minus 2, the divergence of the space, minus the number of external flat connections, minus 2, the number of the order parameter field. For instance, if you take one loop, you have the amplitude 2J insertion, 3J insertion, 4J insertion, 2J insertion, 1K naught, and 2K naught. Otherwise, the theory, the amplitudes are finite. So only five amplitudes. You have to evaluate the divergent terms of these five amplitudes in order to get all the one-loop divergences of the nonlinear sigma model, all infinite expressible in terms of these five. So you understand why it's tempting now to say, well, then I will try to find out a subtractive scheme in order to make the theory completely finite. If I manage to subtract these five amplitudes, then I've reached my goal. I've made the theory finite. First, I've proved that the number of independent divergence amplitude is finite. Then I find the method to subtract it, to subtract them, and then I've reached my goal. So this is the summary of what I was saying before. If we have a normalizable theory, these are the criterion. The last one, unfortunately, is not at hand because the theory is not renormalizable. We replace by a weak power counting, which...
What do you mean by counting exactly?
What's your definition of counting? Well, you count the dimension of the action terms, and if it is above higher than 4, then you know that the theory is not stable. If it is less or equal to 4, then you know that after a normalization, it stays in that good position. Here is not true. When you make the first subtraction, then your theory becomes worse. And you, after, take one loop, take the first subtraction, then the theory becomes even more divergent, and so on and so forth. So we have got hierarchy and weak power counting. Weak power counting is the requirement that at every number, at every fixed number of loops, the number of independent divergent amplitude is finite. It's an extremely powerful criterion. How to proceed then? To implement this two requirement, well, you go back to the equation. You have, in principle, you have to find the solution of this equation. Of course, you are looking for the contour terms because you want to remove the divergences. So they must be local function of the fields. So you have to solve this. As I told you, this one is a transformation, gauge transformation on J. This is a transformation, a local transformation on the five fields. So this is a, in order to solve this problem, it's very easy to play the following game. You bleach all the elements of your, all the elements entering, the variables entering in the game, you bleach by phi. That means that you make them invariant under transformation. Once they are invariant, then you can build all the contour terms that you want. So this is the technical tool which is also used sometimes in the normalizable theory. It's bleaching. So you take the transformation property of fields and sources, and then, knowing them, you bleach all the ancestral fields by phi naught and phi. Now comes the problem, how to subtract the theory. Let me repeat that you cannot assign a parameter to every independent divergent amplitude. If you do that, then at every step in the loop expansion, you make the theory worse and worse. So you need an ad hoc prescription in order to remove the infinities. First, I give you the prescription, and then I tell you how you can prove that it works. You put a factor lambda d minus 4 in front of your amplitude that you have evaluated in d dimension. You remove only the pole singularities, no finite terms. Then you introduce the necessary contour terms in the Feynman rules without free parameters. For instance, you have to avoid on-cell renormalization. That means that the parameter entering in the action are completely dummy indices, dummy variables that has to be fixed against experimental measurement. Why does it work, this procedure? The proof is rather involved, and give you an idea. You consider the nth order n loop expansion here, and you write this in terms of the lowest contour terms. Then you can prove that with this procedure, if you do the last subtraction, the terms disappear, the breaking term disappears. And therefore, you prove that by doing this kind of subtraction, the equation is invariant. It's a rather technical proof, but hopefully it is correct. So the end of the sigma model is summarized in the following way. We have a local functional equation, which implies hierarchy and weak power counting. We propose a subtraction, an ad hoc subtraction. The number of parameters are invariant. There are always two parameters, which are V and lambda. And the theory is finite. Now we move to the electroweak model. We have the SU2 left and the U1 right. So the nonlinear sigma model field transform to the left with SU2 local and to the right with U1 local. We have to add BRST invariance in order to have physical unitarity. And at the end, we get two equations, Slavnov-Taylor, that everybody knows, but we have a new one, which was unknown before, which is the local functional equation. Of course, from this, we get hierarchy, weak power counting, and the strategy to subtract the divergences in the final model construction. I repeat, this is a completely new function equation. It's not everything beautiful. After we have replaced the phi naught, the Higgs field, by this constraint, we discover that by using the weak power counting, we get a new mass-like term, which I don't write here, but I mean, it has been written in full detail in the calculation of the self-energies of the WZ. We have an extra mass parameter, and therefore the relation between the mass of the W and the Z does not obey anymore the relation involving the Weinberg angle. They are free. We have an extra parameter, so that these two masses are free. It seems that if you go to grand unifying theory, then this is fixed again to the Weinberg angle. But this work has not been finished. You get a bonus. In our scheme, we can introduce a mass for the neutrinos in comparison to the standard model, where the mass of the neutrinos, Majorana neutrinos, are not allowed by power counting. They break the normalizability. In our case, this is allowed. So, this is our job. The first objection is that it cannot be true. Okay, I mean, we cannot help. We try to do our best. We do not follow algebraic renormalization. Of course, we have an infinite number of possible contact terms. This is a more serious objection. Our scheme is based on dimensional regularization. This is true. We cannot, we have not been able to find a method in other regularization scheme to perform the same subtraction. We hope to be able to circumvent this this problem by writing the explicit dependence of the amplitude from the parameter lambda, and then impose with another regularizing method to impose the validity of the same equation, though fixing at each order the value of the finite value of the amplitude. But this is still in our dream, so hopefully. This is a very interesting point. We do not have a normalization group of invariance. Since the number of contact terms is infinite, of course, we don't have the possibility to get this property. It will be replaced by something else, but we don't know yet how respectful will be our proposal. V is not a physical parameter. Okay, that I've proved it already before. So that is the main problem about unitarity. So it's better not to hide our head in the sand and see what is really the problem that we have to face. We have perturbative unitarity is guaranteed by the fact that we have Slavnov-Taylor identities.
Yeah, that's like you said earlier.
Exactly. So perturbative unitarity is okay. The problem is that when I look at the, let us give you an example of the nonlinear sigma model. If I take the forward amplitude for pi-pi scattering, okay, in our scheme, it behaves like S with the center of mass of the two pions divided by the mass parameter which ends in the nonlinear sigma model, which is to the power n number of loop plus one. This is quite a safe statement. It's not based on dimensional analysis. It's based really on exact. We don't know, of course, the coefficient here, unless you are up to n equal to, okay, we know it, but not higher. So you see that you make higher loops, number of loops, and this becomes higher and higher unless S is less than V squared. So V is going to be a natural scale for our theory. Since this is connected to the total cross-section of pi-pi, you see that we have a problem with unitarity. But to be clear, unitarity is valid for the region where S is less than V square. It is the problem of what happens above this scale. We don't know whether you can approach the theory in strong coupling in some way or then connect to this region, we don't know. So this is a problem which is common to most of the field theory that we know, of course. But, I mean, it's better to point it out. They seem...
Just to understand. So this is the typical approach of effective field theories. No?
Which one?
Having a theory that is varied up until some energy. So
there is a huge difference. They have a number of parameters which increases with the number of loops. I have only two parameters. Moreover, my theory under, below this scale is unitary. Their theory is not unitary. They have no control on unitarity.
So, in the Stein and Higgs model, you calculate, well, you're going to talk about this, but you calculate this, the tree graph level.
Yes.
Without Higgs exchange, it goes like S.
Yes.
Which is bad.
Yes.
Already exactly. Tree graph.
Yeah. So, exactly. In the literature, you find a lot of discussion about unitarity, and what they consider is this. New L longitudinal W meson in the electricity scattering. And the conclusion is that if you take away the X contribution in these graphs, you find a very bad behavior for large energy. I have many objections about this kind of argument, and I give you some of them. If you look at their equation, final equation, you find that the amplitude are built with the massless Young-Mills theory. I repeat, massless Young-Mills theory. You don't find any mass inside. If you are in a massless Young-Mills theory, the longitudinal polarization is not a physical polarization. It's an unphysical polarization. So it's a little bit strange that the people can discuss very high energy behavior of the theory by using three graphs, approximation, and for polarization, which are not physical. Moreover, in that limit, you have terrible infrared divergences. So you cannot consider forward amplitude. You can at most introduce a cutoff angle, and you can integrate the cross-section up to that angle, but that is the end of it. So you cannot speak about total cross-section. So I find myself, I find the argument based on this process as a little bit inconclusive, to say the least. In formula, it's my objections are extremely practical. The optical theorem tells you that the forward amplitude is connected to the total cross-section. But in that limit, the forward amplitude is ill-defined, does not exist, because you have infrared divergence. So this relation is void. Moreover, you have to pay attention what means perturbative unitarity and unitarity. Perturbative unitarity tells you that if you expand the S-metric in some parameter, say, for k greater than zero, then you have an identity like that. This is perturbative unitarity. But if you want to check unitarity straight away, then you see that you have a big problem because you start with S matrix, you make a huge effort, you evaluate from zero to a value, say, k. So you make evaluation from j to k, this is the sum of all your terms, and then you try to check whether unitarity is valid. Well, you do simple calculation, and you find that this is not one, but this, you have a series of Bricken terms like this. The picture is very simple. If you put in a all the elements of your expansion, say you go up to second order, by doing this, you sum all elements of this square. But perturbative unitarity goes along this diagonal, which is good up to 2. But if you go higher, then this term is missing. And this term, and this term, this term, and this term are missing. So unitarity here is valid up to order k. When you go higher, it's not anymore valid because a lot of terms are missing. If they are small, then you can say, okay, it is almost valid. But if they are large, then you are lost. And in our case, they are large. So, let me finish with, well, I don't know if it's the case to, what should we do? Well, it's a very heavy job to fit the precision data at low and medium energy with our model. Then maybe try to fit the data at LHC energy when they come. Of course, if the Higgs boson is found, then our theory is no use. Of course, the third case is extremely clear-cut answer. Although I would say once we are able to put forward a theory which is consistent and there is no X, one can ask why. To give you an idea how hard it is for the people to find the X, this is the Fermilab, this is the background, 1710. And these are the number of total event, positive event. And of course, being the situation so unfavorable, they can exclude only a very little tiny region here. They can exclude the X with this mass.
Did you dominant decay of W plus W minus. This is about twice the W mass. So they've sort of excluded a place where you expect H naught into W plus W minus to be seen.
These are the events they are looking for. I think they are looking for B bar jets.
Yeah, but you see the point. 160 GeV is roughly twice the W mass.
Yes.
So in that region there, you're expected to have seen H naught into W.
Yeah, that is the reason. That is the reason why the background is so big.
So this is important.
Sure. That is the reason why the background is enormous. I agree with you. So one thing that you never have been told, because what they show you is the blue line fit. When we try to make a fit, we find a very funny situation. Give you a feeling what is behind a chi-square fit. You have a certain amount of numbers coming from particle data group, and you have a certain number of parameters entering in the model. Now, look, the mass of the W is essentially G times V in the standard model. The muon Fermi constant is essentially V minus 2. And alpha is electromagnetic charge, is G times sin theta W. So in your fit, E has practically no error. G has practically no error. So V is fixed. And therefore, when you take theta W, you get G. When you have G, you put it here inside, and you look whether your W mass is correct. So what happens? That experimentally, saying theta W is, there are two experiments. One is the electric scattering of neutrino, and the other is the forward-backward asymmetry in the at the Z0 resonance at LEP. And the results are pretty different. So what happens? That an error in G of 1% enters here in 1%, but this is around 200 MeV, so it is 140 GV. So this makes an error in G would make a quantity of the order of 2-3 GV, which is exactly the value of the self-energy that you have evaluated. So it's completely crazy. I mean, I don't know how the people can do any reasonable fit in such a situation. This error of 1% in G reflects in an error in the mass of the W, which is the same order of your correction, one loop correction of the self mass. So this is the kind of problem that we faced. Okay, this was the end of it. Thank you for your attention.
I mean, you didn't really explicitly, or maybe you did before I came in, write down what your electroweak model looks like.
It's the same.
The
replacement is that instead of the H field, I get the square root of 1 minus phi square, and I have an extra mass term.
For what?
Because we don't have the constraint of... Okay, take this. Okay, you make this an invariant by taking the phi c data. Okay, this is invariant under SU2.
Yeah, but you need to be Lorentz invariant, so you need
No, wait.
Okay.
This is SU2 invariant, but it's not U2 invariant. If you multiply by okay, the B term is missing, but never that. This becomes invariant. Lorentz invariant, SU2 invariant, U1 invariant. In the In the standard model, this is rejected because it has dimension 6. In our model, this satisfies all the requirements of the power count, weak power count. So we have to introduce it.
Well, what I was going to ask is there are presumably current data constraints. I mean, I know you alluded to this a bit, but presumably current data puts considerable constraints in your model already.
Not yet.
Have those been not at all?
No, we are finishing the one-loop calculations.
Because if you believe in a Higgs, then the mass of the top, when incorporated into loop corrections for self-energies and so on, constrains the range of the Higgs. So since you don't have a Higgs, presumably those kinds of processes will do something to your model.
No, but it's not, the situation is not like that.
Why not?
Because the fit of the best fit graph, the blue curve tells you that fixing the mass of the top 174, the mass of the Higgs has some probability to stay in some place, but I mean, it's sometimes they are embarrassing values for the Higgs mass in order to.
Sorry, sometimes they what?
They have embarrassing value, the mass of the Higgs. Like, for instance, 80 GeV.
The point is that the global fits have been done to electroweak gate.
Yeah.
And the best fit, if you take all the data into account, is 116 point something plus 20 minus 2 GeV. So the global fits, there are four of them there. With the Higgs mass and the low, it's a light Higgs. If the data forces a light Higgs, so does the supersymmetric one. So when you look at the dominant loop correction, which involves the top mass, because the top mass is the higher top, it's so heavy, forget everything else, forget about everything else. It's a vacuum position calculation. Then the Higgs correction comes in as log m h squared over m w squared. And since the best fit is m h of order 80 GeV, which is the mass of the w, we all know the log of 1 is 0, so it turns out that the dominant loop correction you can do without the Higgs for a light Higgs. This is very important, because if that isn't true, then we wouldn't be doing this, because we already know you need a Higgs from the data. You see what I'm saying? Another issue is you said that MW over MZ, MW squared over MZ squared, cos squared theta, theta is the one we can do. It's a free parameter.
In my case, because I have an extra parameter from this.
The data does show that it's called the rho parameter.
Yes.
And the rho parameter measures the ratio of the neutral curves to the charged curves.
Yes.
And experimentally, that is close to 1. The 1 comes out of the 3-graph calculation in the standard one. So you have to get 1 plus a small quantity to fit the data.
The truth.
So how do you do that?
Well, it's a free parameter for us.
Okay.
So that's what I meant. So that at least is constraining your model. My question was, how is current data constraining?
Yes, exactly. We did a preliminary fit, but only by using the self-energy, which are well known to be the most important contribution to the one loop. The vertex is not so important. It's almost irrelevant. And the fit is not bad.
Bottom line is that the Higgs from all the data, the Higgs mass is divided between 115 GeV and 140 GeV. That's it. right now. The tenotron is running at an integrated luminosity of 10 inverse femtopoles. So within about a year, it's possible for the tenotron to exclude the Higgs at 3 sigma. Or
there's no wiggle room in that limit? Isn't there some model dependence going on in the assumptions?
No, there's no wiggle room. So within a year, they combine the D0 and CDF experiments, you can exclude the Higgs at 3 sigma. But if they see a bump, something, then they need 5 sigma, which is going to be right. So something's going to happen within the next year. And my prediction is that they're going to exclude it. So then we're getting into this phase.
So, you have more parameters, right? And
one
more.
Only
one.
Yeah. And instead of the mass of the Higgs, we have the lambda, which is standing in front of the whole axiom.
So is it one more than the mass? So the standard model, including the Higgs, you have one more than that?
Which one? This one.
Okay. So in other words, you drop the Higgs, but you gain 2 parameters.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, what? How do you understand fermion masses? Because in the standard model, they're coupled to Higgs.
They are the same, because here we have the coupling is through omega. So you get right, omega left. Here you have the mass from, and this one, when you take the field equals 0, the Gostom field gives 1, so you get immediately the mass parameter.
So it is sort of a Yukawa kind of term.
Yes. The difference is that when you go higher, then the guy here, you have the linear term, which is as in the standard model, but when you go higher, this phi naught develop.
Square root thing.
Exactly. Develops things like graphs of this type, that means you have fermions with 2 Goldstone bosons out, and so on and so forth. And these are very important because they are needed to satisfy unitary, perturbative unitary.
So here, standard model, you have 12 free parameters. You can't branch because we have 12 books and lectures.
The same here.
Same here.
Yeah, more than that. What about mass mixings? What about mass mixings?
Yes.
No, I'm just talking about the mass.
Yeah, there's the Yukawa matrix.
Mass matrices that have all the CP.
Just take them. You count Lagrange and fit the 12 quarks and leptons, you get 12 parameters. But on top of that, you've got CK.
Yeah, CKM and all that stuff.
But that's regarding the unitarity, regarding this tree graph calculation, www.2, which is in all the textbooks.
Yes.
Except they don't do the calculation.
I agree.
You have to read my paper. the problem is that if you take just one angle, scattering angle, I agree with you about the. If you calculate for theta pi over 2, then the thing diverges like crazy, goes like S.
Yes.
So to me, I agree with you. Issues about forward scattering and so on. To me, that's already bad. But for one particular angle away from forward scattering, the whole thing goes crazy. This is not good. But I mean, this optical theorem has always been a problem. Because when you do photocopter scattering, the photon is massless. So when you go to the forward angle, it's very difficult. There's always been a problem.
Always. But unitarity has been always a problem for nuclear physics. Glauber made a function about that.
60 years or 70 years.
And people
are still
struggling about the Pathé approximant for years.
But still, the www if they can measure at some angle, fixed angle, this is a very important measure. The LHC.
It's beginning to turn into a private discussion.
Sorry, I...
Thank you.
Actually, can I just...